BBC World Service for Africa. Hello, this is Janet Anderson with Postmark Africa. And this week, Postmark Africa is coming directly from Washington, D.C., the capital city of the United States of America. In a packed program, what is the International Monetary Fund and what's it doing in Africa? How do veterans of the Vietnam War fit in today's America? And fossils, how do you tell how old they really are? But first, do you remember this man?
I've done my very best, in all the days since, to be true to that pledge. As a result of these efforts, I am confident that the world is a safer place today. This, more than anything, is what I hoped to achieve when I sought the presidency.
That was ex-President Richard Nixon making his resignation speech from the United States presidency on August 9, 1974. Even though there he was extolling the virtues of his own administration, he left office with a huge black mark against his name, the Watergate scandal. What effect did Watergate have on President Nixon and the institution of the presidency? I'm now in the Washington office of Daniel Shaw, senior news analyst for National Public Radio. He wrote a book called Clearing the Air, published in 1977, and he's going to help answer some of these questions. Daniel, good morning.
Good morning to you.
Now, let's start with Thaddeus Olofot's letter from Amukura in Kenya. He wants to know, what were the chief causes of the Watergate scandal?
Well, there were several causes, but the one cause that was most direct had to do with an order that was given from somebody in the White House, presumably because President Nixon wanted it to happen, to put a wiretap on a telephone of somebody in the offices of the Democratic National Committee, and at the same time to have some people break into the Democratic headquarters and try to get certain information. Oddly enough, even to this day, there are questions raised about what it was they were really looking for. It would appear that President Nixon feared that the chairman of the Democratic Committee then, Lawrence O'Brien, had some information which might have damaged Nixon in the 1972 presidential campaign, and was interested in finding out if that information existed in the files of the Democrats, and if so, to try to ferret a way out of their files. Also to try by wiretaps to find out what it was they were talking about and what their campaign strategy was.
Even as you detail it now, it sounds like a rather incredible story. Everyone must have been very shocked at the time.
Not only shocked, but at first simply incredulous at first. And it took weeks and then months to develop bit by bit the information which indicated where this all had been inspired from. It really seems so bizarre that Americans, first of all, had trouble believing it, and then believing it, found it difficult to believe that anybody with any responsibility would have instigated it.
And the person that we're talking about these threads leading back to is ex-President Nixon.
Well, in a general way, they led back to Nixon, although Nixon would issue general orders saying, I'd like to know what they have over there. Can somebody find out for me? And then, as this goes down level by level, this gets translated into more specific and more conspiratorial kind of instructions. I am not sure that President Nixon ever directly said, I want you to break in Democratic headquarters and try to steal their files. What I am sure of, and what was shown, was that once it had happened, that he took direct part in trying to orchestrate a cover-up of this, that he talked about the money that could be given as payoffs to potential witnesses to try to keep it from getting into court. I'm less than sure of his direct responsibility for the Watergate break-in. I am more than sure of his responsibility for the obstruction of justice that followed.
He did have to resign as a result of the Watergate scandal, but does that actually mean that he could never take up office again?
He resigned. He was not impeached. He was not thrown out. In the end, there was an agreement by which he resigned voluntarily, and I suppose that theoretically, at least, and constitutionally, there would be nothing that would prevent him from running for office again. So I don't know the answer to that question.
Now, P.V. Williams from Sierra Leone wants to know exactly what the word Watergate means.
There is an area along the Potomac River here in Washington which is called the Watergate. It was because at one time, but no longer, there was actually a kind of a dam there over which the water flowed, and that's called the Watergate area. The Democratic National Committee's headquarters were located in the Watergate office building. And so when the break-in occurred at headquarters, they occurred in this place called Watergate, and Watergate gave its name to everything that followed.
In recent times, there has been another scandal, also with the name Gate added to it, Irangate. Is that simply connecting it back to Watergate, or is this name Gate have any special significance?
No, the Gate, indeed, once you had Watergate in the trendy way that the media operate in this country, that then becomes a part of every word that is fashion.
Daniel Shaw, thank you very much indeed. As you walk the streets of Washington, it's obvious that it's home to a large number of international institutions. Maybe it's the way everyone's wearing a suit and swinging a briefcase. One of those institutions directly affecting African countries, and certainly one of the most important, is the IMF, or to give it its full title, the International Monetary Fund. I've been to investigate. I'm standing now in the middle of a huge 13-story glass and concrete building in the center of downtown Washington. This is the headquarters of the International Monetary Fund, or IMF. Busy office workers are strolling past me, and I'm sure you can hear the noise of the small waterfalls decorating the entrance hall. This building was built in the 1970s, but the IMF itself dates back to 1944. To a big conference of economists and governments who wanted to plan solutions to the economic problems they knew would be coming after the Second World War. Now the IMF receives money from every member country, according to its position in the world economic order. So, for example, America gives just under 20% of the total every year. And the IMF gives out loans whenever a country gets into financial trouble, paying back other debts. I'm going to see Aziz Ali Mohammed, the Director of External Relations for the IMF. And the first question I'm going to ask him is from Anthony Isabiri in Lesotho, who wants to know which countries are members of the IMF.
At the origin, there were no more than about 40 members.
Were they all members of the Western world?
No. There were two members. Czechoslovakia was one and Poland was another, who joined at that time. But the membership is almost universal when you think it's 151 member countries. There are industrial countries, developing ones, socialist countries, as well as capitalist ones.
Is it a profit-making organization?
Oh, no, not at all. What we have is a cooperative in which countries deposit a part of their reserves, and on which the fund draws in order to help member countries when they have foreign exchange problems.
Sunday Adedeje from Ikeja in Nigeria wants to know what denomination of money you use at the IMF, or whether you have some kind of special printing press for your own money.
No, we don't have a printing press for our own money, but we do use a certain unit of account to denominate our transactions in, and that is known as the SDR, or the special drawing right. Now, this is a composite of five currencies which are the most frequently used in international trade, and they are the US dollar, the pound sterling, the Japanese yen, the Deutsche Mark, and the French franc. And the value of the SDR is determined day by day, depending upon what is the relationship among these five currencies. Today, the value would be, let's say, one SDR equal to $1.25 US.
A correspondent in Kenya, whose name unfortunately I don't have, who describes himself as a teacher and ex-banker, asks very specifically about SDRs, or special drawing rights. He understands that you base the value on these five currencies, but he wants to know why you don't just use the dollar. Wouldn't it be simpler if you just used a US dollar as your base?
The idea of using a unit of account was to make it possible for the IMF to be able to create its own reserve currency. And the SDR was meant to be such a currency.
Now, to return to Sunday Adedeje, he also wants to know what you do with your profits.
What we have done in years where we have had a profit, in the sense that we have had receipts of income that were larger than the payments that were made out to the countries whose currencies we had used, was that we have added them to our reserves. And the purpose of reserves is to meet any obligations that are not repaid, so that the fund and its membership is protected from non-payment of its claims.
Following on from that, if a nation can't pay back this money, what actually happens to that country? Do they remain a member of the IMF?
They are suspended from further use of the fund's resources. But we have not had a single instance so far of a member being suspended or expelled from the membership. Although that is a legal possibility, it has never been invoked.
Do you think there is any chance in the future that it might be?
Can you see any countries who
are likely to invoke the wrath of the IMF upon them?
I think the wrath has been invoked, but it has never been extended to the point of expelling anybody. And after all, this is a cooperative, and you are trying to work with members. Members must be in desperate straits if they are unable to pay the IMF. And one must make a clear distinction between countries that are unable to pay and countries that are unwilling to pay.
That was Aziz Ali Mohammed, Director of External Relations for the IMF. But now I've switched offices, and now I'm going to talk to some of the people who are directly concerned with IMF policies in Africa. They are Evangelos Kalamitsis, Deputy Director of the Africa Department.
Good morning.
Burke Dillon, Head of the Southern African Division.
Good morning.
And Saleh Nsuli, Head of the Sahel Division.
Good morning.
Now, Aleo A. Silla from Freetown in Sierra Leone has written asking,
IMF conditionalities are often a bone in the throat in third world countries. Are there third world countries whose economies have been rectified by the conditionalities? If any, are these economies still okay? If none, why?
Also from Sierra Leone, Victor A. Jones writes from Pendembu,
the IMF imposes some very harsh conditionalities before the granting of loans to debtor third world countries. These include currency devaluation and raising of government subsidies. Does this precept help to bring economic relief to these countries?
Now, perhaps we could start off with you, Mr. Kalamitsis. Perhaps you could explain to us exactly what conditionalities are.
I would say conditionality is a matter of good economic and financial policies. That's what conditionality means. And the government concerned approaches the fund, seeking our assistance, our financial assistance, our technical assistance. So the question usually is, here we are, ready to help. You have a problem. You have a financial problem. You have a balance of payments problem. And the question that is asked is, what do you intend to do about them?
Let me turn to you, Mr. Nsuli. One of my Nigerian listeners thinks of the Structural Adjustment Programme, or SAP, as the toxic pill of the IMF. Do you agree with that?
I think that there are real economic problems that have to be dealt with in these countries, with or without the IMF, and which will force a solution. And in many of these countries, I think the choice is not between adjusting or not adjusting, but it is more between having an orderly process of adjustment that attempts to maximize the benefits of adjustment versus a disorderly process of adjustment where adjustment is forced on the country. Therefore, one has to look at adjustment programs as the pill necessary in order to cure these problems and bring the benefits of orderly adjustment to the country.
Do you sometimes get frustrated in the IMF when you're working with a government? The policies get imposed, people object to them, there are riots in that country, for instance, let's say Zambia or Sudan, and then everybody says in the government, well, we won't actually impose these policies, it was all the IMF's fault in the first place. Do you actually find yourself thinking, but it wasn't us?
No. You know, I've worked on both sides of the table. I've been in a government on the side of the United States, and I've worked with governments from the side of the IMF. And these are, you know, there's never any ultimate decision. Policy is something that's made, you know, month to month, and will have to go on being made. And we have a dialogue. At certain points, there'll be a time when there's sufficient agreement on the dialogue that it can become part of a program, and we think there's a basis to go out and really try and mobilize resources with the country. But even when, you know, the press talks about disruptions with the fund, usually the dialogue is going on. It looks much more dramatic off and on from the viewpoint of the newspaper than it does from those of us who are working constantly with these governments. Often, you know, the times when there's been frustrations, it's been as much shared with the authorities, you know, sitting around with the governor of the central bank, equally frustrated together about trying to deal with a certain situation.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kalamitsis, Ms. Dillon, and Mr. Nsuli of the IMF. Now for my next expert, I went along to the National Museum of Natural History. I went to see Dr. Jack Pierce, who's head of the paleobiology department. That means that he spends a lot of time looking at fossils, the pieces of rock impressed with the shapes of creatures which were alive maybe millions of years ago. I had a couple of your letters to ask him about. The first one is from Ebo Paintsill from Matatule in Natal in the Republic of South Africa, and he wants to know what is the oldest known fossil. Now, Jack, can you help us with this one?
The answer to that is how you define what is the oldest fossil. If you look at what is generally known as fossils to most people, are those with hard shells, the oldest ones are somewhere between 550 and 570 million years old. If you go back to something that is unicellular, bacteria, that sort of thing, you're looking at 2 to 3 billion years old if they can identify actual life forms.
Now, you've given us a couple of time periods then that these fossils were found in. Now, we have another question in from a listener in Ethiopia called Jonas Abebe from Addis Ababa. And he wants to know about the methods and techniques used to measure geological time periods. Now, let's take that first lot of fossils you were talking about, the hard-celled ones. 570 million years ago, how can you tell?
Generally associated with some of these are igneous intrusions or something of that sort, which have radioactive isotopes of certain elements, uranium, which decay at a given rate. Based on how much of it is left, we can determine how old the deposit is.
And how accurate would you say that this type of dating is?
It would depend on the amount of radioactive elements you started with, how much you have left, how well the decay rate is. Generally, they look at the worst case would be about an error rate of plus or minus 10%. Say on 550 million years, you're looking at an error of 5.5 million years on either side.
Thank you very much, Jack Pierce.
Quite welcome. I'm happy to do it.
Yes, it's Star Question time. One of the biggest events this century for Americans was the Vietnam War. It lasted more than 10 years, involved millions of soldiers, and deeply split the entire nation. Desmond M. Eze from Jos in Plateau State, Nigeria, wants to know about the people who fought in Vietnam and about the psychological effects it had on them. Tom Birch is chairman of the National Vietnam Veterans Committee, and he represents 30,000 of the 2.9 million servicemen who came back from Vietnam. He fought there himself in the late 1960s. I asked him whether most of the people who'd fought in Vietnam had been teenagers, drafted into the army.
Most of them were in the, well, I would say more 18 to 19 age group, and most of them were draftees right out of school. They there weren't very many volunteers during that war.
How did people feel about being drafted at that time?
Well, it depends on where you were. Now, I was from the South in the United States, which is the Virginia, the old Confederacy, from the Civil War. And we came from a tradition that it was an honor to serve in the military. On the other hand, in the northern states, they did not like the war. They didn't support the administration, and they used a various evasive tactics that we're used to.
What kind of things?
Well, there were actually several things that they would do. There were the legal things and the illegal things. The legal things that they could do is, for instance, if you got assigned to the National Guard or the Reserves, that you could wouldn't have to serve in military service. Then you had the illegal means. Basically, it was illegal if you were called up to draft not to, report for duty, and if they didn't do it, they could be prosecuted under the law, and there were people that went to that extreme. The main reason, if you could not fit into one of these exemptions, and people who wanted to fit into one of the exemptions, especially if they had some money, could get out of it, but maybe the person who did not have any funds and just wanted a quick way out, they would go across Canada was the usual way. And there were probably about 50,000 or 60,000 people that did that.
Now, we've spoken a lot about people trying to avoid serving in this war. Was that because the actual aims of the war were not supported by people and on a political level, or was it because they didn't want to fight? What was it about Vietnam that people objected to?
Well, I think you put your finger on it. What about the aims? First thing, the aims were not clear. And also, what they did is the media coverage of that brought the war into everybody's living room. Now, what was available is what the Americans were doing. You didn't have a balance of it. I could give you an example. There's a very famous Pulitzer Prize picture of a Vietnamese general shooting a Viet Cong in the head and it was murder. In the streets of Saigon. Now, that picture galvanized a lot of public opinion against the war. But what they didn't tell you in there, there's about an hour before that this general, Vietnamese general, had seen his sister and his nephews disemboweled, all cut up and mutilated in cold blood by the Viet Cong.
It sounds like a very negative war from the way in which you're speaking about it, very bloody, very violent. How did that kind of violence and so on affect the troops who then came back to America after a tour of duty?
Well, you had two elements. You had first a frustration because the military is used to, if it has to go and do this nasty, dirty job of killing people, go in and get the job done. But so often you'd have a military operation, you get ready to do it, you know where the enemy was, and you have to pull back, or you don't do too much because the negotiations are going a certain way. Number two, the lack of public support you felt very much. We would capture documents from the Viet Cong, and they would recite, "We're losing the war militarily, but because of Jane Fonda and other things were happening in our country, the war demonstrations, if we hold out, the American support will collapse." And then, of course, it also affected when we came home, what kind of reception we had.
What kind of reception did people have?
It was unbelievable. And the binding influence among Vietnam veterans is not the combat experience, it's what we call the coming home experience. Basically, you're spit upon, you're called baby killer. If you put on a job resume that you were a Vietnam veteran, you couldn't get a job. I have a very good friend of mine who came home, was not met at the airplane, came up to the his home, saw his sister run out. She thought he was going to greet him. She says, "You can't come in. You're in uniform. I got friends in my living room that won't understand you. You've got to go in the back door, take your uniform off before you can come in the house." And you can you have any idea mentally what that did to a man who had felt he'd served his country, had paid the price, had been wounded, incidentally, and he couldn't even come into the front door of his house. He had to take his uniform off like it was a disgrace. Very bad, and it's taken us years to get over that.
Tom Birch, thank you very much. Desmond M. Eze, your book prize is on its way for your star question. That's it from this week's edition of Postmark Africa, coming to you from Washington, D.C., in the United States of America. Don't forget that copies of the AIDS handout are still available from Postmark Africa, BBC, Bush House, London. And that's also the address for your letters. Keep them coming. This is Janet Anderson saying goodbye.